want to welcome you back to Prophecy Update with Dr. Andy Woods. And here we're getting into the third installment on our series on Calvinism, which promises to be sort of a lengthy series, but right now we're just getting into the subject of why critique Calvinism on a show like this, Prophecy Update. Is this really something that relates to prophecy? And so we're talking a little bit about the prophetic implications of Calvinism. One of the things that you see in Calvinism is a perpetual mishandling of prophetic passages. And we talked a little bit about this in the prior show, just had a chance to briefly mention it. And now let's get into a little bit more detail as time allows. One of the things you see in the book of Revelation, chapter 17 and verse 3, is a woman sitting on a scarlet beast. The woman, in other words, rides the beast. And essentially what we're being told by many people is that the woman, whose name is Babylon, is not in Mesopotamia in the east, but actually she is in Rome in the west. And this comes from this idea that the woman that's riding the beast is associated with the seven hills of Rome. Revelation 17, 9 and 10 says, "Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits, and they are seven kings." Now, this is a study of great interest in and of itself. In fact, on this very show, Prophecy Update with Dr. Andy Woods, we've done some in-depth treatments on the subject of Babylon. I've tried to explain that the woman is actually Babylon in the east, not Rome in the west. But many people believe that the seven mountains represent the seven hills of Rome. And what we're trying to say here is the seven mountains do not represent the seven hills of Rome, because first of all, they're called seven kings. And the book of Daniel chapter 2 verses 37 through 38 uses king and kingdom interchangeably. So this is not the seven hills of Rome when you look at this in terms of exegesis of what the passage actually says. So why is it that so many people think that Babylon equals Rome? Well, you can trace that view right back to the early reformers like John Calvin, who took this prophetic passage and misinterpreted it and misapplied it. This is quite common, actually, in the writings of Calvin, to misunderstand and misconstrue prophetic passages. And I'm using this as a justification as to why we need to examine neo-Calvinism, because a lot of the prophetic errors found in Calvin's writings related to prophecy continue on in the neo-Calvinist movement right up to the modern day. So it was Martin Luther who began to discover that if you called the Pope the Antichrist and the papacy Babylon, then the common people liked that and they wanted to hear that, and that began to preach well. Here's a quote from Martin Luther where he calls the papacy the Pope. He calls it here the Antichrist. In fact, you notice what he says here. He calls it the damned Antichrist. So this idea that the Pope is the Antichrist and Babylon equals Rome, that whole misunderstanding of that prophetic passage in Revelation 17 verse 3, Revelation 17 verses 9 and 10, we have that misunderstanding largely because of the writings of the Protestant reformers like Martin Luther. Now you'll notice that John Calvin in this particular quote here does the exact same thing. He talks about the papists. He says Daniel 9:27 and Paul in 2 Thessalonians 2 verse 4 foretold that the Antichrist would sit in the temple of God. It is the Roman pontiff we make the leader and the standard bearer of the wicked, abominable kingdom. And then he goes on here, John Calvin, and he says, there we shall see the face of Babylon. So this whole misunderstanding that we have today, that Rome equals Babylon, and the harlot of Revelation 17 is not the literal city in Babylon in the east, but it is Rome in the west, we wouldn't have that view if it weren't for the misunderstanding of that passage, the misconstruing of that passage, the misinterpretation of that passage, not only by Martin Luther, but also by John Calvin. So this becomes an example as to how Calvinism is known for not handling well prophetic passages. Let me give you some more examples of this. Calvin's mishandling of prophetic passages is very common in his treatment of the Old Testament prophets. He doesn't let the passage say what it wants to say. He doesn't allow the passage to speak of a literal future for Israel, but he adopts an allegorizing method of interpretation as he misconstrues these passages. Notice what Calvin says here about Isaiah chapter 35 and verse 1. Isaiah 35 and verse 1 says, "The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad." It's speaking there of the physical restoration of Israel, what we've even seen in our lifetime, how the land and the nation of Israel is going to come back to life. And rather than take that passage for what it says, here's what we find in the writings of John Calvin. He says, "I pass by the dreams of the Jews." He just calls it a dream. "Who apply all passages of this kind to a temporal reign of the Messiah, which they have contrived by their own imaginations." He says, "I willingly view this passage as referring to Judea and afterwards to other parts of the world." He says, "Let us now see when this prophecy was fulfilled or shall be fulfilled. The Lord began some kind of restoration when he brought his people out of Babylon, but that was only a foretaste, and therefore I have no hesitation in saying that this passage, as well as others of a similar kind, must refer to the kingdom of Christ," which he interprets as the church, and that kingdom is transpiring now. "In no other light could it be viewed if we compare it to other prophecies." So notice how Calvin not only mishandled the Babylon passages, but the passages relating, such as Isaiah 35 verse 1, to a future for the nation of Israel, he mishandled and misconstrued passages of that nature as well. You'll notice here that Calvin, in his commentary, and he commented on almost every verse of the entire Bible, says this concerning the book of Amos, chapter 9 and verse 13, which says, "Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that the plowman shall overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes him that soweth seed, and the mountains shall drip sweet wine, and all the hills shall melt." Now that's a wonderful passage about the millennial reign of Christ and the nation of Israel given preeminence once again during the millennial reign of Christ. And notice what Calvin says of this passage. He calls it a mere metaphorical expression. He says, "Here the prophet describes the felicity which shall be under the reign of Christ, and we know that whenever the prophet set forth promises of a happy and prosperous state to God's people, they adopt metaphorical expressions." In other words, it's not literal. "And say that the abundance of good things shall flow, that there shall be the most fruitful produce, that provision shall be bountifully supplied." Watch this. "For they accommodated their mode of speaking to the notions of the ancient world. It is therefore no wonder if they sometimes speak to them as children. At the same time, the spirit under these figurative expressions declares that the kingdom shall in every way be happy and blessed, or that the church of God which means the same thing, shall be blessed when Christ shall begin to reign. Notice how Calvin is misconstruing Bible prophecy here. Notice how he is taking these expressions as figurative and non-literal, and they seem literal only to the childish mind. But of course, that's not what God had in mind. These are all prophecies about the current church and the kingdom of Christ. It has nothing to do with the future of the nation of Israel. This is so common in Calvin's writings concerning prophecy. He wildly allegorizes any prophecy related to a future for Israel out of existence. He goes on, and here he is quoting Zechariah chapter 14, verse 4, which is a tremendous prophecy when taken at face value of Jesus Christ returning, his feet touching the Mount of Olives, and the Mount of Olives splitting in two. Zechariah 14, verse 4 says, "And his feet shall stand in that day on the Mount of Olives, and the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst there forward to the east and to the west." I mean, anybody knows what that prophecy means if you take God at his word. Jesus Christ is coming back to the Mount of Olives one day, and the Mount of Olives will split. A simple meaning. But watch what Calvin does. He manipulates the passage. He misconstrues the passage. He says, "For as we are dull and entangled in earthly thoughts, our mind can hardly rise up to heaven, though the Lord with a clear voice invites us to himself. The prophet then, in order to aid our weakness, adds a vivid representation." In other words, this is just an accommodation to a weak-minded person. It's not meant to be taken literally. If you take it literally, you're basically a child or a simpleton. He goes on and he says, "As though God stood before their eyes. Stand, he says, shall see his feet on the Mount of Olives." He does not here promise a miracle, such as even the ignorant might conceive to be literal. You take this prophecy literally, you're considered a child and ignorant. He goes on and he says, "Nor does he do this in what follows when he says, the Mount shall rent half to the east and half to the west. This has never happened. That mount has never been rent, but as the prophet could not, under those grievous trials which might have overwhelmed the minds of the godly 100 times, having extolled the power of God, and without employing a highly figurative language, he therefore accommodates himself, as I have said, to the capacity of our flesh." In other words, God never really intended to mean that Jesus is coming back and he's going to rend the Mount of Olives east to west. He just speaks that way because that's all our flesh can understand in its childish state. It's really meant to be understood allegorically, you see. And it's no wonder that modern neo-Calvinism trashes Bible prophecy, debunks Bible prophecy, stays away from Bible prophecy, when their leader, John Calvin, did the same thing over and over and over and over again in his own writings. He doesn't just mishandle the passages concerning Babylon, but he mishandles the passages concerning Israel's future. And so if you attach your theological wagon to John Calvin, you're attaching yourself to someone that allegorized and spiritualized Bible prophecy out of existence and explained it away over and over again. Now, coming at the end of the millennial reign of Christ will be the 1,000-year reign of Christ. How do we know that this 1,000-year reign of Christ will be literal? Well, you'll notice we have a few reasons on the screen as to why 1,000 means 1,000. First of all, John knows how to use indefinite concepts elsewhere, like short time, long time. He doesn't do that here in Revelation 20. He just gives us a literal number. Whenever you have a number plus years in the Greek New Testament, it's always literal. And if you allegorize the number 1,000 in Revelation 20, what do you do with all of the other numbers in the book of Revelation? Two witnesses, 7,000 people, four angels, 144,000 Jews, 12,000 from each tribe, 42 months, 1,260 days. All of those become allegorical as well. And the interesting thing about Bible prophecy is when it wants to be understood non-literally, it will tell you. For example, Revelation 17, verse 8 says that the harlot is a city. Now, obviously, the harlot there is not meant to be taken literally because the harlot is identified as a city, but we don't have that with the number 1,000. It never says 1,000 equals something else. So you put all of these things together, and it's very clear that 1,000 means 1,000. In other words, Jesus Christ is coming back at the end of the tribulation period, and then and only then will he start his 1,000-year kingdom. Robert Thomas, in his excellent commentary on the book of Revelation, says or observes, no number in the book of Revelation is verifiably a symbolic number. But watch what John Calvin does with this literal, normal understanding of a future 1,000-year kingdom. John Calvin says this in his Institutes of the Christian Religion. He says, but Satan, in other words, if you believe 1,000 means 1,000, and you believe in a future 1,000-year kingdom reign of Christ that we teach here and believe in, he says you're being influenced by Satan. Satan has not only befuddled men's senses to make them bury the corpse of the memory of resurrection, he has also attempted to corrupt this part of doctrine with various falsifications. Now, their fiction is too childish. In other words, it's a childish belief to believe in a future 1,000-year kingdom. Their fiction is too childish either to need or to be worthy of a refutation. And the apocalypse from which they undoubtedly drew a pretext for their error does not support them. For the number 1,000, Revelation 20, verse 4, does not apply to the eternal blessedness of the church, but only to the various disturbances that awaited the church while still toiling on the earth. In other words, this is a prophecy that's happening right now, John Calvin says. Those who assign the children of God 1,000 years in which they will enjoy the inheritance of life to come do not realize how much reproach they are casting upon Christ and his kingdom. If you believe in a future 1,000-year kingdom, then you're bringing reproach upon the body of Christ. You're involved in falsifications. You're being influenced by Satan himself. And you've bought into a childish error that's deceiving people. I mean, this is so common in the writings of John Calvin, this rewriting of Bible prophecy and dismissing Bible prophecy. In fact, it's so bad it demands a response from us here on Prophecy Update with Dr. Andy Woods. And it's so interesting to watch people magnify Calvin. And as they magnify Calvin and salute Calvin, they follow the exact same errors that he followed in his mishandling and misunderstanding of Bible prophecy. Here's Kenneth Gentry, a Calvinist, following Calvin's method of interpretation related to the 1,000 years. Gentry says the proper understanding of the 1,000-year time frame in Revelation 20 is that it is representative of a long and glorious era and is not limited to a literal 365,000 days. The figure represents a perfect cube of 10, which is the number of quantitative perfection. So like produces like. People that idolize Calvin will typically move into this mindset where they will spiritualize and allegorize Bible prophecy. One of the worst ways Calvinists do this relates to their complete mistreatment and mishandling of Matthew chapter 24, verse 13. This is in the Olivet Discourse. And Jesus says, the one who endures till the end will be saved. Now, what is he talking about here? He is speaking of the events of the Great Tribulation period. This is why so many of the birth pangs that are described in Matthew 24 line up so well with the seal judgments that we see in the book of Revelation. Jesus, right in the middle of that discourse, quotes Daniel 9, verse 27 in Matthew chapter 24 and verse 15, related to how the Antichrist will desecrate the Jewish temple midway through the tribulation period. So what does this mean when it says he who endures till the end will be saved? The context is a Jewish context in the future. After all, Jesus says, do not let your flight take place on the winter or on the Shabbat, Sabbath, Jewish context. He talks about those living in Judea at the time to flee into the mountains. I mean, it's obviously talking about the Jews in the tribulation period. And the one who endures to the end, the one, in other words, who makes it to the end, will be protected by the personal return of Jesus Christ to the earth from the wrath of the Antichrist, who will be pursuing the Jews during this final 3.5 years of this 7-year tribulation period. That's what an honest exegesis or analysis of that particular passage, Matthew chapter 24, verse 13, will yield. So how do Calvinists handle this? They completely manipulate the passage. They make it sound as if this is somehow support for their doctrine of the perseverance of the saints. I've got to make it to the end, not of the tribulation period, but I've got to make it to the end of my life in good works to prove I'm one of the elect. So once again, it's just another example of how neo-Calvinists take prophetic passages out of context and really don't have much of a conscience about it and don't have any problem manipulating and altering Bible prophecy. Notice the words of John MacArthur in his commentary on Matthew, and here he's commenting on Matthew 24 and 25. And quite frankly, when you read through John MacArthur's commentary here, he does a pretty good job with the Olivet Discourse, but then it's almost like a different person takes over when he gets to Matthew chapter 24, verse 13, because it fits his Calvinistic theology. And he starts to ignore the context of the passage, which we developed just a moment ago. Notice what the John MacArthur commentary says. It says this, but the one who endures till the end shall be saved. His endurance will be a spirit-empowered product and proof of the reality that he is saved. Neither the high cost of discipleship, nor the deception of the false prophets, nor the enticement of sin will cause true believers to renounce Christ, because he himself will protect them from defection. Endurance is always a mark of salvation. The perseverance of the saints in faith is a very, very basic element of salvation reaching in the New Testament. It states that people who are genuinely saved do not depart from the faith. And here he gives you a slew of Bible verses that supposedly support his doctrine of perseverance of the saints that have nothing to do with the context of this passage. Endurance does not give the evidence of spiritual life. Endurance does give evidence of spiritual life that resides in the believer. This is so common in neo-Calvinism. They take a passage related to prophecy and just twist it to support their preordained theology, in this case, the perseverance of the saints, which has nothing to do with the events of the tribulation period and the Jews making it to the end of that tribulation period to be protected from the wrath of the Antichrist by the return of Jesus Christ. And this passage and its misuse of it was what we would call a game changer in Calvinism. We will be explaining that Calvinism and John Calvin himself derived a lot of his thinking from Augustine, who lived at roughly 1,000 years or actually more. We'll discuss that down the road. Notice what Dave Anderson says concerning Augustine and his mishandling of Matthew 24, verse 13, and how that was a game changer in his theology. Dave Anderson correctly says, we choose Augustine as a case in point, specifically his reinterpretation of Matthew 24, verse 13, he who endures to the end will be saved, as spiritual salvation instead of physical salvation to enter and populate the millennium caused drastic changes in his, that's Augustine's, soteriology, which is his doctrine of salvation. Perseverance of the saints, faithfulness until the end of one's life, became the sine qua non of, which means without which there's nothing, the sine qua non of his soteriology. One could believe in Christ, have the fruit of the elect, but prove he was not elect if he should not persevere in faithfulness until the end of his physical life. Close quote. In other words, their mishandling of Matthew chapter 24, verse 13 was a game changer in terms of leading Augustine in the direction of a misinformed belief system, and it all arose out of their disrespect for the context of Bible prophecy. Here's an interesting quote from Robert Congdon, researcher of neo-Calvinism. He says, most Calvinists do not believe that Christ will return and reign on the earth for 1,000 years, nor do they understand that those of the church age will return to rule with him following a time of review before his judgment seat or Bema seat, when our roles and responsibilities will be determined. Most Calvinists believe that the Great White Throne judgment is for everyone of all ages, and it will determine whether one is truly saved or not. In neo-Calvinism, you don't have a distinction between sheep and goat judgment, Bema seat judgment, Great White Throne judgment. They make it all one giant judgment where you're going to pop up at some judgment at the end to determine if you have enough fruit to prove you're one of the elect. Again and again and again, Calvinism and neo-Calvinism is mishandling key passages related to Bible prophecy, and that's why we're dealing with this subject and confronting it here on Prophecy Update with Dr. Andy Woods. We hope to see you next time as we continue. God bless you.